We'll hear argument now, number 04480, MGM Studios versus Grokster Limited. Mr. Verrilli.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, copyright infringement is the only commercially significant use of the Grokster and Streamcast services, and that is no accident. Respondents deliberately set out to capture a clientele of known infringers to stock their services with infringing content. They intentionally and directly promote infringing use of the service. They support infringing use of the service, and they directly—
Just interrupt with the one. You said the only significant use. There's a footnote in the red brief that says the figure is some 2.6 billion legitimate uses.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor.
Correct or incorrect?
I think it's an absolutely incorrect assertion of reality, and perhaps I could delve into it and explain why. The evidence in this case, which was presented at summary judgment, showed that 90% of the material on the services was either definitely or very likely to be infringing.
Was there a finding of 90%?
Well, this was submitted on summary judgment, Your Honor, and we lost summary judgment, so the evidence has got to be construed in the light most favorable to us. And the Ninth Circuit decided the case on the assumption we submit of 90%. But with respect to that 10%, what happened, and we submit is completely wrong, is that the Ninth Circuit drew the inference because it wasn't shown by our expert study, which, by the way, is the only empirical analysis in the case, to be infringing, that the court could assume that it was non-infringing and then extrapolate from that to a number along the lines of the number that Your Honor suggested. And I think that that's a completely illegitimate analysis factually. And besides, that number is big only because the overall activity is so big. The scale of the whole thing is mind-boggling. If there are that many non-infringing uses,
yes, but it goes to the accuracy of your statement that there is no other significant legitimate use.
I don't think there. I think it's quite accurate on the summary judgment record, and certainly drawing the inferences in our favor, as we must here on this summary judgment record, that there is no commercially significant non-infringing use.
But they could be. They could be, both with respect to material in the public domain and with respect to people who authorize the transmission.
I don't think in the context of this record and this case and the business model of these defendants, Grokster and Streamcast, that is true, Justice Ginsburg. I don't think that's right. I think what Grokster and Streamcast are arguing is that this court's decision in Sony stands for the proposition that their massive actual infringement gets a free pass, a perpetual free pass, so long as they can speculate that there are non-infringing uses out there, such as public domain uses and authorized uses. We don't think that Sony stands for any such proposition. We also want to point out that doesn't help them, that proposition doesn't help them with respect to one very significant part of this case, and that's the fact that they intentionally built a network of infringing users, and they actively encouraged and assisted infringement. Now, even if there are commercially significant non-infringing uses, and we submit there most definitely aren't under Sony, but even if there are, that's no defense to a contributory infringement claim based on intentional building up of an infringing business and active encouragement and assistance of infringement. And it can't be, because otherwise, then the fact that they had commercially significant non-infringing uses, again, would be just a free pass to actively promote infringing uses, not merely to support them, but to promote them. And so
your argument, I take it, would be the same if the proportions were reversed. Your argument with respect to your current argument with respect to infringing use would be the same if it were assumed that only 10% of the use were illegitimate and infringing. Is that correct?
The active encouragement aspect of our argument would be the same.
That's
certainly
right.
They don't get a free pass to encourage any infringement.
Is that the same as active inducement?
Yes.
That
I think
term
there's a
is
lot of,
used?
Yes, Justice O'Connor. There's a lot of lingo floating around in this case, inducement, active encouragement, and assistance.
If we should think that the respondents are not liable for the type of contributory infringement dealt with in Sony, could this court reach the question of active inducement on this record?
Yes, very definitely. I think the court, of course, should find that there's contributory liability under the Sony
I know
theory.
You
but
do,
with respect
but I
to
just
that
said,
theory,
could you
yes.
assume for a moment that sure. That we just, didn't could we nonetheless address the active inducement?
Yes, Justice O'Connor, and let me explain why. The district court in this case issued a partial final judgment under Rule 54B, granting the respondent's summary judgment motions. Now, we argued for contributory liability on two theories in the district court and in the Ninth Circuit. We argued that there was a lack of commercially significant non-infringing use under Sony, and we argued the inducement or active encouragement theory. We argued that both theories entitled us to relief against the current operations of the service, to entitle us to damages and entitle us to injunctive relief to eliminate the harmful ongoing infringing consequences of this intentionally built-up infringement machine. The district court granted summary judgment against us and gave a clean bill of health, gave absolution, essentially, to the current versions of the services. The only thing that was left to us, as the Ninth Circuit and the district court understood the law, is that we can go back and try to show that with respect to specific past acts of infringement, if we can show that they occurred at a time when we had given them notice that they were about to occur, and that we had the power to, and that they had the power to stop them at the moment we gave them the notice, that we can get damages for those specific things and those specific things only. That's all that's left in this case, and I think it's quite clear from the Rule 54B certification order of the district court that it was only damages for the past services and the past acts.
It's not clear to me from your brief, focusing on the contributory aspect of it, not the inducement part. It's not clear to me from your brief what your test is. What do we tell the trier of fact? That if there is a substantial part of the use which is non-infringement, if there's any part?
Here's what I think the test is.
Leaving aside the inducement.
Right. Here's what we think the test is on what we'll call the Sony aspect of the case. That it's the question here is that Sony poses, seems to us, is really a touchstone kind of question, not a numerical kind of question. The question under Sony is whether this is a business that is substantially unrelated to infringement. In other words, are they building their business on supporting legitimate activity, or instead are they building their business supporting infringing activity?
But then we just throw this to the birds on the trier of fact, in every case substantial.
No,
how do we know?
I think, and then that's where you start. That's the touchstone. Now, the numbers, the relative proportions of use, are relevant. In a case like Sony itself, certainly, where the majority use was non-infringing, that's a legitimate business. You don't need to go further. In a case like this one, where taking the record at summary judgment in our favor, as it must be, and the Ninth Circuit's assumption that you've got 90% infringing use, billions and billions of acts of infringing use, and minuscule actual non-infringing use, it seems to us it's just
You're using different tests. Your test was substantial. All right, on your test, are we sure, if you were the counsel to Mr. Carlson, you could recommend going ahead with the Xerox machine? Are you sure, if you were the counsel to the creator of the VCR, that you could recommend, given the use copying movies, that we should ever have a VCR? Are you sure that you could recommend to the iPod inventor that he could go ahead and have an iPod, or for that matter, Gutenberg with the press? I mean, you see the problem.
Yeah, I think my answer What's to those questions answer? Are yes, 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 and yes.
Because in each sure, case, because well, I know the monks had a fit when Gutenberg made his press. But the problem, of course, is that it could well be in each of those instances that there will be vast numbers of infringing uses that are foreseeable.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. Certainly not. I don't think there's any empirical evidence to suggest with respect to any of the things that Your Honor just identified. And let me pick out the iPod as one because it's the most current example, I guess. From the moment that device was introduced, it was obvious that there were very significant, lawful commercial uses for it. And let me clarify because that's something I think is unclear from the amicus briefs. The record companies, my clients, have said for some time now, and it's been on their website for some time now, that's perfectly lawful to take a CD that you've purchased, upload it onto your computer, put it onto your iPod. There is a very, very significant lawful commercial use for that device going forward. And remember, what our test is not substantial. Our test is that when there's a vast majority use like here, it's a clear case of contribution.
How do you know going in, Mr. Varelli? I mean, I'm about to start the business. How much time do you give me to bring up the lawful use to the level where it will outweigh the unlawful use? I have to know going in. And it's one thing to sit back and you know, calculate with this ongoing business, it's 90%, 10%. But I'm a new inventor, and I'm, you know.
I think the way.
I'm going to get sued right away. I know I'm going to get sued right away before I have a chance to build up a business.
I don't think that's right, Your Honor. And here's why. It's not just the absence of commercially significant non-infringing uses that demonstrates contributory infringement. Right? You have to demonstrate that you're making a material contribution with knowledge that you're doing so. The inventor at the outset is not in that position. They're not making a contribution with knowledge that they're doing so. Do they have absolute certainty? No, they don't have absolute certainty.
But I don't quite understand. I take it inventors are profit motive driven, and if they know that something that they're working on is going to have copyright experience, copyright problems, you can't just say, oh, well, the inventor's going to invent anyway.
Or
did I misunderstand you?
No, I think that you have to show contribution. You have to be making a material contribution with knowledge that you're doing so.
The inventor of Xerox does that. I mean, he puts out the machine. He knows he knows a lot of people are going to use it to Xerox books.
I don't think that's right, Justice Scalia. I don't think there's anywhere close to a showing. I don't think there could be anywhere close to a showing that you've got the vast majority of use for infringement from the time that the device comes out. I just don't think that's
realistic. Well, let's go from Xerox back to your iPod. How is that clear in the iPod case? I may not understand what people are doing out there, but it's certainly not clear to me. I know perfectly well I could go out and buy a CD and put it on my iPod, but I also know perfectly well that if I can get the music on the iPod without buying the CD, that's what I'm going to do. And I think it's reasonable to suppose that everybody else would guess that. So why in the iPod do you not have this Damoclean sword?
Well, because I don't actually think that there is evidence that you've got overwhelming infringing use. I just think
there's never evidence at the time the guy is sitting in the garage figuring out whether to invent the iPod or not. Right.
I think when you have vast majority infringing use, they should be on the hook. Now, I don't
you're not answering the question. The question is, how do we know in advance on your test anything that would give the inventor, or more exactly the developer, the confidence to go ahead? As was said a minute ago, he knows he's going to be sued immediately. There isn't a product performance out there, as there is in this case. So on your substantiality theory, why isn't it a foregone conclusion in the iPod that the iPod loser or developer is going to lose his shirt?
Well, first of all, I think it's just counterfactual to think that there's going to be overwhelming infringing use of the iPod in the way that there indisputably is here. Second, to the extent you get to closer cases, it is our position, as I gather it is the position of the United States, that you look to see what kind of business model the defendant is operating under. Are they marketing it for legitimate purposes? Are they taking reasonable steps to prevent infringement? If they are, then they're not liable. Third,
That's your second argument, I think. I thought you were going to just stick with the first one. I mean, that's an inducement argument.
Yeah, that's
isn't
an inducement.
It?
No, I don't think it is an inducement argument because it doesn't go all the way to requiring us to show, as we can show here, that they've got intent. But I do think that the issue is, you know, really in the real world, you know, it isn't the case that these guys have gotten immediately sued. That's just not right. The reality is that what happens is what happens here. There's perfectly valid uses.
But it is the case under the test you're submitting to us.
No, I don't think that's right, Justice Kennedy. If there's vast majority infringing use and you continue to operate your business with the knowledge that there's vast majority infringing use, then you've got liability. Now, of course, we do have all the additional inducement facts here, but we've also got those facts. And in the real world,
are you dealing with active inducement as just a theoretical add-on, or is that a satisfactory way to resolve this case?
I think that it is a. I think neither is the
pitch.
Answer. Neither, neither is the answer. It is a basis for resolving this case, but not to the exclusion of getting the law right on Sony.
But you couldn't get summary judgment. Your reply brief said this case is so clear that we should get summary judgment. If inducement is the theory, you have just said you have to show intent. So yes. You could not. You'd have to go to trial.
We agree with that. We think in a situation where the vast majority of the use is infringing and there isn't any evidence of a legitimate business plan on the Sony part of the case, we would be entitled to summary judgment. We agree with you, Your Honor, that with
Sony itself had a trial.
That's right.
Trial.
It came after the trial. That's right. But the a key point I think I want to make here is that this is not about this technology. What happens in the real world is that inventors come up with technology. Some people use it for lawful purposes and valid purposes that some people use this technology for. Some people abuse the technology to run businesses that are devoted to expropriating the value of copyrights. That's exactly what's going on in this case. If I could reserve the balance of my time, Mr. Chief Justice.
Very well, Mr. Verrilli. Mr. Clement, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the decision below allows companies like respondents to build a business model out of copyright infringement without fear of secondary liability, as long as they avoid obtaining actual knowledge that a particular customer is about to infringe a particular copyright. They are free to operate a system that involves massive copyright infringement with full knowledge that the draw of the entire system for customers and advertisers alike is the unlawful copying, no matter how much of that system.
What do you think Sony allowed? It talked about if it's capable of substantial non-infringing use, it's okay?
That's right, Justice O'Connor. And then I think the Court explained and elaborated that the test is whether or not there are commercially significant non-infringing uses. And I would say what the Ninth Circuit did in this case is basically adopt the test of mere theoretical capability for non-infringing use, plus maybe some anecdotal evidence.
And what in your test is whether there's a substantial use that's lawful?
Well, I think the way we would try to articulate it is that if the way that the business model of the particular defendant is set up is that they are not involved in a business substantially unrelated from copyright infringement, that there should be liability in that situation. And I think in an extreme case like this, where over 90% of the business, and I think Mr. Verrilli correctly describes it, it's not a minimum of 90%, it's over 90%, because the only evidence on the other side is anecdotal evidence that there are such things as public domain works.
Where did the 90% figure come from? I know we have to accept it because it's summary judgment, but where did it come from?
It came from a study by petitioners' experts of the actual operation of the system. And what they did is they identified about 75% of the works as clearly infringing works. Another 15% of the works were identified as very likely infringing works. And then there were 10% they just couldn't tell anything about.
I thought it was just limited to music.
Well, I think the system is not limited to music.
I know, but I thought the study was about music.
I'm not sure about that.
Well, we've had 90 briefs in this, and some briefs tear it apart and others support it. But we also have briefs from the ACLU saying you could put whole libraries within this system. The question I wanted to ask you is, given that concern that there are conceptually, anyway, really excellent uses of this thing, does deliberate
actual inducement?
Yes, because what you were worried about, it seemed to me that the actual inducement would take care of. And if you sent it back and said, let's have a trial on actual inducement, if this really is the extreme case you're talking about, why wouldn't the petitioners here be bound to win that trial?
Well, based on our review of the record, and we haven't been able to see the entire record, I agree with you that petitioners ought to be able to win this case on an active inducement ground, and that's a narrow way to decide the case. I do think, though, this Court might have to say something about the Sony issue before it reached that issue, and if it did feel compelled to do that, I think it would be a mistake to sanction the Ninth Circuit's reading of Sony. Because you're right, there's a theoretical possibility that public domain works can be exchanged on this system, but it's also true that this system doesn't have much of a comparative advantage for trading in public domain
works. Well, you got interrupted a bit. Tell us, in the simplest way you can, what test you think Sony stands for and how the Ninth got it wrong, if you believe it.
Justice O'Connor, it stands for, the test is whether or not there are commercially significant non-infringing uses. The Ninth Circuit got it wrong because it thought that test was satisfied by a combination of two things. being able to point out that there were such things as public domain works or authorized sharing of a Wilco album, for example, and anecdotal evidence that you could actually do that. Now, if that were the right reading of Sony, with respect, I would suggest that footnote 23 of this Court's Sony decision would have been the sum total of the Court's analysis. Because in that footnote, the Court observed that there were broadcasts of public domain works.
Suppose the owner of the instrumentality, the program, thinks that there's going to be a vast area of lawful use, and he knows that there's going to be some abuse in the short term. But he does everything he can to discourage that. He said, now, this P2P is going to revolutionize the way we talk to each other. There's things in the public domain. Please don't use this for copyright. But he knows that there's going to be some infringement, let's say, that it will be 50% of the use in the short term. Can he use the program?
If it's 50% infringement in the short run, we think absolutely yes.
Yes, that he can use the program.
I mean, as we suggest, if you're at a 50-50, I mean, if you're anywhere below 50%, we think that there should be no liability under the Sony standard. If you're above that level and there's sufficient evidence that you're really targeting infringing uses, then I think maybe there would be liability. But in the hypothetical you suggest, there would clearly not be liability in that situation. What we would like to suggest, though, is there ought to be enough room under the Sony test before you reach actual inducement to capture somebody where they've clearly set out as a business model to deal with the infringing uses. And the only thing they point to are the theoretical possibility, anecdotal evidence, that it could be used for public domain work.
If there's more, they could bring it out at trial, could they not? I mean, the difference between your position and Mr. Varelli, I take it, is that you think there should be not summary judgment for the petitioners, but a trial.
I think that's a fair point, Justice Ginsburg. We're operating at something of a disadvantage because we haven't seen the entirety of the record. Based on the record that I've seen, I think there's a close case, unless perhaps once this court clarifies the legal standard, respondents put on additional evidence. I think this is a close case where you actually could grant summary judgment in favor of the petitioners. But certainly we have no objection to having a trial on the Sony issue in this case. What we object to is the Ninth Circuit rule, which in every case is going to obviate the need for a trial based on a showing that there are such things as public domain works.
The inducement point doesn't get you very far. Presumably, a successor to Grapster, or whatever this outfit is called, could simply come in and not induce anybody, but say, you know, we're setting up the same system, know very well what people are going to use it for, but not induce them, and that would presumably be okay.
I think that's potentially right,
which is why you need the Sony.
And that's why I think it's important to preserve a role for the Sony test. And again, this court in Sony could have adopted a simple theoretical capability test, but this court instead adopted a test that required there to be shown some commercially significant use for the non-infringing use. And even in the patent context, where I think the test is and should be more demanding, even in that context, cases like Fromberg, which we cite at page 19 of our brief, show that there is an analysis to make sure that the suggested theoretical non-infringing use is in fact a practical use of the
you
item.
Give a company 10 years to establish that?
Well, I don't think one would...
I mean, what I worry about is the suit that just comes right out of the box as soon as the company starts up. Will you give the company a couple of years to show that it's developing a commercial use?
Well, Justice Scalia, we have concerns about that as well. I don't know that we would give them 10 years of sort of free space to facilitate as much copyright infringement as possible. I think what we would say is that when a suit targets a nascent technology at the very beginning, there ought to be a lot of leeway, not just for observed non-infringing uses, but for the capacity of non-infringing uses. I don't think, in fairness, that's what you have before you in this case. Because this is a case where the peer-to-peer technology was out there. It was employed in a particular way with a centralized server in a way that was actually had a lot of users involved in it, and they were users of the old Napster system that had a distinct character. They were using that system for infringing copyrighted musical works. And then these individuals come along and seek to capitalize on that market. That is their business plan from day one. And it's not some newfangled idea. The only newfangled idea here is that if you give something of value away for free by ignoring the copyright laws, you're likely to draw consumers to your site and you're likely to attract advertisers. But that cannot be the kind of innovation that we want to in further through a development of secondary liability under the copyright law.
Mr. Clement, in one way, this presents an easy case for answering Justice Scalia's question. But what about a case in which there isn't the Napster example to start with? Should there be some kind of a flexible ripeness doctrine in response to suits, as Justice Scalia put it, against the inventor or developer right out of the box?
Well, whether you call it a flexible ripeness doctrine or you develop the doctrine in a way that is very forgiving
converse
of brand new technology.
Converse of laches.
Right. I think the way I would style it is to develop a substantive standard that's very forgiving of brand new technologies and allows people to point to, in those situations, capabilities for future uses. I do think
how would you express the how would you express that substantive standard that anticipates, just as you suggested we do?
Well, I was just trying to articulate it, which is to say that this court has talked about the capacity for non-infringing uses. I think with a mature product like this, it's fair to point to how it's actually used in the marketplace.
Thank you, Mr. Clement.
Thank you.
Mr. Toronto, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Because respondent software products are tools of autonomous communication that have large and growing legitimate uses, their distribution is protected under the clear Sony rule. That rule should be adhered to by this court because copyright does not generally step into the role of product control because doing so would cause overkill. The Sony rule safeguards legitimate uses by protecting the product.
Yeah, but active inducement is a doctrine that's been employed to curb the intentional encouragement of non-infringing uses, isn't it?
Not in copyright law, it hasn't, but that's not my primary point. My primary point is that it is critical, it is jurisdictionally critical, to separate two separate acts, distributing the product and any of the past acts that the petitioners allege constituted encouragement, their synonym for inducement, which were explicitly outside the district court ruling that was certified for interlocutory appeal. Questions about past acts not inherent in the distribution of our product remain
They are inherent. They are inherent. I mean, the point is that those past acts are what have developed your client's current clientele.
No, I don't think so, Justice Scalia. The petitioners, this is what I think is here and usable about the past acts. They claim that there is an intent as part of the current distribution of the product to profit from increased use, including generically known infringing use, a point on which the District Court and the Court of Appeals assumed to be the case. Beyond that, the question whether there were encouraging acts, any kind of promotional activity that says, we ask you to and urge you to use this product for infringement, that is not here because that was explicitly part of the past activities removed from the district court decision. And when the petitioners sought interlocutory appeal, they said expressly these were distinct and severable. In their terms, that's a quote.
But I don't understand how you can separate the past from the present in that fashion. One, I suppose, could say, well, I'm going to make inducing remarks Monday through Thursday, and I'm going to stop Thursday night. The sales of the product on Friday are still going to be sales which are the result of the inducing remarks Monday through Wednesday. And you're asking, in effect, you're asking us to ignore Monday through a Monday through Thursday.
No, I'm not. Let me try to be clear. There is a theory not present here along exactly those lines which petitioners are entitled to argue back in the district court without a remand because that issue remains in the district court. It is a theory that says you started your business with illegitimate acts. Your current business is a causal consequence of that. I will say there is not one bit of evidence that the petitioners introduced in resisting summary judgment in support of that theory. It is, in fact, a highly implausible theory for reasons that the district court can explain because users of software like this switch readily. There is no plausible lock-in effect to this software. People go from Kazaa to Grokster to eDonkey to BitTorrent week by week. That is an available theory.
Why was inducement as a current theory of recovery even a subject of summary judgment? It seems to me that to make it a summary judgment is implausible to a non-worldly degree.
I'm not entirely...
I thought you were saying that so far as the inducement theory of recovery is concerned,
yes,
the only summary judgment that was granted was with respect to current acts of inducement, the way the company is acting now, not the way the company was acting last year. And my question is, if that is correct, then I don't see how summary judgment could even intelligibly have been considered.
I think because, as the petitioners insisted when they pressed for interlocutory appeal, they said these were distinct and severable because, as Justice Scalia referred to before, the important question on a going-forward basis is whether the current set of activities, this software, given how it operates, being generally distributed, is it renders the distributor of that software secondarily liable, because somebody else tomorrow can do exactly the same thing without the baggage of any past acts.
I don't want to get us too far off the track on this question, but it just seems to me that what you've done before bears on what you know or have reason to know on an ongoing basis.
I agree with that, Justice Kennedy, but there's no dispute about that. This case was decided on the assumption, which we are not contesting here, that the respondents here knew that there would be widespread infringing use of a product that they were putting out, and what's more, that they intended to profit from maximum use of the product, which necessarily would include infringing use, which they had no ability to separate from non-infringing use.
Then why don't you tell us what's wrong with the government's test and with the petitioner's test, the substantial use part?
Well, I'm not entirely – I think there are several tests, and I'm not sure I followed them all here. We think it is critical that the court adhere for innovation protection to the very clear Sony rule.
Mr. Taranto, is something I find very puzzling. There is a statement, one could take it as clear, capable of substantial non-infringing use. That would be very clear, I agree. But Sony goes on for 13 more pages. If the standard were all that clear, it would have stopped there. And usually when you're interpreting a document, one rule is you read on, and if you read on, you find we need not give precise content to the question of how much use is commercially significant. That doesn't sound very clear to me. Or if you then read back, as a careful reader would, then you find the statement that the primary use of the Sony machine for most owners was time shifting, a use that the court found either authorized or fair and hence non-infringing. So I don't think you can take from what is a rather long opinion and isolate one sentence and say, aha, we have a clear rule.
Well, that sentence, Justice Ginsburg, is expressly stated to be the rule of law that is being applied. And then the court went on to apply it to say there are two things that satisfy the test. The primary thing, of course, is what takes up most of those 13 pages, the question whether in-home time shifting is fair use, a question that was of considerable interest to tens of millions of individuals throughout the United States. But the court, in fact, didn't rely only on that. It said, in addition, there was this roughly 7% to 9% use of authorized time shifting. It wouldn't have had to even talk about that if the primary use, you know, was the entirety.
Mr. Varela, I hope you won't waste a lot of your time on this point. This court is certainly not going to decide this case on the basis of stare decisis, whatever else is true.
Well, let me urge that there is in fact considerable weight to stare decisis, because there are major technological industries that have relied on the rule that derived from patent law, that there is no kind of predominant use kind of meaning to the Sony rule. In the patent context from which this came, all there has to be, in Professor Chisholm's words, is uses that are not far-fetched, illusory, uneconomical for the user. And the inquiry there is this a product whose where the same features that are alleged to cause the infringement are also, in some non-trivial way, used for non-infringement.
But what is the answer to Justice Kennedy's question? I took it whether that for the last 21 years, industry throughout America has taken the standard as being approximately whether it is capable of substantial, commercially significant, substantial, non-infringing uses.
Yes.
And the country seems to have survived that standard. There is innovation. There are problems in the music industry, but it thrives and so forth. So there is an argument for just following it because it's what it is. But suppose it's totally open. Why should that be the right test instead of some other test, like substantial use, et cetera?
I
think was the question, and I'm very interested in your answer.
Right, because I think any alternative is worse. A focus on intent to profit means that virtually every business which requires money and has the least bit of sensible forward-looking thinking about what the usage is going to be will be subject to litigation arguing about their knowing that a substantial amount of the value of the product was going to be based on infringement.
But what you want to do is to say that unlawfully expropriated property can be used by the owner of the instrumentality as part of the startup capital for his product.
And
just from an economic standpoint and a legal standpoint, that sounds wrong to me.
Well, I'm not entirely sure about that formulation. Sony clearly sold many more tapes because of the illicit activity of librarying. Sony presumably sold more machines, maybe even priced them higher, because there was a group of people who wanted the machine for the illicit activity. The Apple iPod in the 60 gigabit version holds 15,000 songs.
So you think unlawfully expropriated property can be a legitimate part of the startup capital?
No. What I think is that as a matter of general, judicially formulated secondary copyright liability law, there is no better policy balance that the court can strike and that only Congress can make the judgments about what the industry-wide facts are. Let me pause there a minute. There are no industry-wide facts in this record. Every citation in the petitioner's brief about the magnitude of harm to the industry is extra record citation. There are 26 billion
figures. Perhaps there should be a trial. So
no,
it would all come out.
Petitioners, it's not just that they didn't have it in their brief. They did not submit any evidence in response to the summary judgment motion that said the rule of Sony should be applied here because the magnitude of the injury to the recording industry or someday in the future to the movie industry is X. Zero evidence.
Well, they weren't concentrating on the damage to them. They were concentrating on the facilitation of copying that was provided. And you don't question that this service does facilitate copying.
As does the personal computer and the modem and the internet service provider and the Microsoft operating system. There's everything in the chain that makes this work is absolutely essential to facilitating the copying. The question is which pieces, if any, and under what standard, get singled out for a judicially fashioned secondary copyright liability doctrine.
When you said, I think you were saying, this is something for Congress to solve, is not for the court. But the court is now faced with two apparently conflicting decisions, Amster in the Seventh Circuit, the Ninth Circuit decision. And if you're just looking at this in the abstract, you might say, well, isn't it odd that Napster goes one way in the Ninth Circuit and this case goes another way?
Let me suggest why that's not odd and why the cases are not just different but critically different. Napster rests never mind the exact words of the opinion. Napster involved something more than distribution of a product. Napster, the company, was sending out, in response to requests, where is this file, an answer, the information, the file is here. Every time it sent out that information, if it had been told by Mr. Verrilli's clients that file may not be shared, it was with specific knowledge to that file, giving assistance. That is a classic contributory infringement case based on specific knowledge of infringement. And the reason
why isn't this a classic willful ignorance case?
Because willful ignorance is about having possession of information and refusing to look at it. That does not occur here. This tool of autonomous communication is one in which there is no mother may I system, no chaperone, no information provided to us at the time that there is any request. When I ask for a file from you, there is no information that goes back to Streamcast or to Grok.
Sure, but I thought willful ignorance was basically a certainty of what was going on without empirically verifying it, so as to sort of maintain the guise of one's hands over one's eyes, and it seems to me if that's what it is, that's what we've got.
No, I don't think so. I think on either account. My understanding of where in the law willful ignorance has bite is when you do have the information right in front of you and you refuse to look at it. And what's more, the change of system to an autonomous communication tool where there is no intermediary, which is what all of their filtering systems would require, getting permission in advance. The change of tool is not just some way of blinding oneself to the information.
Yeah, I think it would also include disabling yourself from looking at it. And so I think it's an important part of your case that you didn't adopt this new system of decentralizing the file so that it's in the computers out there solely in order to get around Napster.
Right, and I think that the summary judgment record on this doesn't leave any real room for dispute.
In respect to that, I mean, is it open? If you win on the question of the standard,
yes.
Is it open, or would we have to remand it for them to argue, in light of the history, in light of what they do now, they, your client, with knowledge of infringement, actively encouraged users to infringe copyright using the Grokster technology, and indeed knowingly would include willful blindness.
I think
because as I've gotten that from one of these amicus briefs, you know, that's their standard, they say, of willful deliberate inducement. And that, it seems to me, important that they be able to argue that. Can they argue it, in your opinion, if we do nothing but affirm the Ninth Circuit?
I think that they can certainly argue with an affirmance by this court that all of the past acts, to use the district court's term, constitute a basis for inducement liability. There would be some legal questions about whether there is such a thing as inducement liability, but they get to argue that. No remand is required for that. The record in this case establishes that one reason for going to the decentralized system without a central index and a third-party intermediary was a reaction to the Ninth Circuit's Napster decision that said that's a legal problem. But it is also, I think, beyond genuine dispute for summary judgment purposes, that there were other reasons. You don't have to have the servers to maintain. When Streamcast in particular was running a Napster-like system, the so-called OpenNAP system, it had 10 servers and quickly maxed out and started crashing and immediately concluded, I think this is at page 789 or 798 and 798 of the joint appendix, we would have had to start doubling, tripling, quadrupling the number of servers, and we didn't have the money to do it.
I'm still a little puzzled about the posture of the case.
Yes.
Because I read the district court opinion. The judge said that both parties agreed that there were no disputed issues of fact that would preclude the entry of summary judgment in either way. No disputed issues relative to whether to grant relief. And I, It's on page 24A of the cert petition. And I understand you to be saying that leaving everything alone, affirming, would allow the case to go forward with your adversary seeking damages on an active inducement theory. Am I correct?
Yes. I think all I read this, page 24A, to say is that both sides filed for summary judgment. So each one, of course, thought that there was that it was entitled to summary judgment.
Each says both parties believe there are no disputed issues of fact material to defendant's liability.
I think that's just because each side filed summary judgment motion. Each side filed extensive.
So then your answer to my question is that, yes, if we affirmed as a possibility, they could continue to seek damages on an active inducement theory.
Yes, absolutely. And there are affirmative defenses that are not even part of this motion that, of course, would by themselves preclude summary judgment in their favor.
One other question I had.
Does the record contain their proposed form of injunction that they requested?
I don't think it does beyond the statement at the end of their summary judgment pleading that asked for a very general injunction, stop the defendants from infringing. I'm not aware of anything more specific. Let me comment a bit on what the record says about the substantial legitimate uses. This is not a question of simply saying.
Toronto, before you go back to that, I wanted to be clear on what you were saying would be left over for trial.
Yes.
Because as I read your briefing, it was, well, they can argue about some bad things that Grokster was doing in the past, but this decision says, henceforth, what we're doing is okay. The case zeroed in on now and the future. And the only thing that was left open was something that is over and gone, could get damages for it, but I thought that this judgment gave you an okay, a green light from now on.
My view that, I mean, this was not talked about in these terms. I believe it ought to be open to the petitioners not only to prove that past acts were themselves illegal, but that the causal consequence of those past acts should somehow reach forward into the current acts.
Then what is the point of the current summary judgment?
The point of the current summary judgment is that there is the forward-looking character of the activities taking place starting in September 2002 on forward has been held by itself not to be a basis for secondary.
So you're saying summary judgment simply, in effect, says they're not doing anything wrong now. But we have left open the question not merely of what they may have done wrong in the past, but whether what they did wrong in the past can carry forward into the future?
As I say, it wasn't stated in those terms, but yes, I think
that's
that,
bizarre.
Well, I don't think so, because the important question is, to the petitioners, the entire recording and movie industry, is this set of activities, which you and I tomorrow can start engaging in, one that they can stop? There are literally a handful, on page 7 and 8 of their brief, of
so you're saying what it really says is there's nothing to enjoin, but there may very well be something to recover for, even as to future activity.
Yes, exactly right. And they would, of course, have had to make the very implausible assertion in a business in which there is no plausible lock-in that somehow a set of isolated events, emails, right, a handful of emails out of literally between the two companies, 1,700 a day, that might have said, why don't you load some music up, are somehow the causal, the cause of what is going on today. Let me say a few words about what the record says about legitimate activities. AltNet is a company. This is at 1169 and 70 of the joint appendix. They say that they have distributed on peer-to-peer systems hundreds of thousands of authorized songs, and they say millions of pieces of video games, leading to sales. This is not a trivial number. Jive, at page 67 to 68, speaks about 250,000 peer-to-peer downloads of a music video. The Internet Archive, which is talked about in the record, and if you now look at what they are on their website, now lists several hundred musical artists with 20,000 recordings, which are being put out there for peer-to-peer distribution. The Creative Commons is licensing all kinds of things for authorized public distribution. There are musical bands.
Because I gather that some artists don't make money from the records, but make money from the popularity that draws fans to their concerts.
So
they're willing to give away the records for free.
My understanding is some is a great understatement, yes. The bands talked about at 159 and 169 to 70 of the joint appendix, which have authorized their live concert recordings to be traded the Gig America business is in the business of compiling, this is at 323 of the joint appendix, of compiling musical recordings and other things for authorized distribution. The world of music distribution and video distribution and movie trailer distribution and, in small instances now, text distribution, but growing, is changing and making use of this extremely innovative, low-cost tool. The great innovation of this tool of communication...
Mr. Toronto?
Yes.
In your motion for summary judgment, did you ask that the plaintiff's claim be dismissed?
We asked for judgment in our favor on their claim that our current activities constituted a basis for secondary liability. I'm not sure if we were dismissed.
Were there other claims? You say on their claim. Did they make other claims?
They had a generic claim about secondary copyright liability. We made the motion, Streamcast made a motion that said, let's carve this piece out and talk just about whether the set of current activities supports secondary liability. The other side eventually agreed that that was distinct and severable from their claim of secondary liability as to past acts and as to past versions of the software which has changed.
Where does one find that?
The motion, the simplest place, I guess, is in the June 2003 district court ruling, which is in the joint appendix and attached to the brief in opposition, ruled on the petitioner's motion for an interlocutory appeal under 1292.
But the motion itself is not there to take it through the opinion of the court?
No, the motion is not in the joint appendix. Most of the motions, in fact, both of our summary judgment motions and their summary judgment motion are in the joint excerpts of record in the Ninth Circuit, can be found in 30 volumes.
The text on pages 23A and 24A gives the impression that the district court is disposing of the entire case.
It may give that impression on those pages. Later, the court explains that it's ruling only on the current versions of the software. And then, in the June 2003 order, the court was explicit in saying, "If I haven't been clear enough, let me amend my April order," which is what you were just reading from, to make explicit the limitation, and we quote that in our brief. The great virtue of peer-to-peer decentralized software is that it doesn't require anybody to put stuff onto a server and then bear the costs of bandwidth, of being charged by the internet service provider when a million people suddenly want it. It automatically scales. The more people who want it, the more people will have it because it will be out there on a million computers. That is an inherent distributional economy together with the autonomy of the user rather than having a kind of mother may I system. was having to check every communication through some third party to say, am I authorized to make this communication, that are the virtues of this system and that make it clearly capable of growing the already large hundreds of thousands, even millions of uses that these pieces of software already enable people to do. One final word. We're not disputing that there are, in an industry-wide way, a set of important policy issues here. Though there's nothing in the record about what self-help measures, digital rights management, encryption, other things, there's nothing in the record about that. There's nothing in the record about what kinds of real industry harm is being done by this, right? This is all citations to websites in their brief. These are classic questions of predictive judgment, industry-wide judgments that Congress should make to decide whether there is a problem in need of solution and what solutions ought to be considered, whether changing the rule would have a overriding bad effect on other industries.
Thank you, Mr. Toronto. Mr. Bellelli, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'd like to start by clarifying the inducement issue and then explain why inducement is not enough, and then have a word, if I might, about the reality of this case. The reason, Justice Souter, you find it bizarre is because a shell game is going on here. The response position here is that we can sue for specific infringements that we can show were induced by these specific acts, such as email support. Our position on inducement is that we're entitled to injunctive relief against the continued operation of this gigantic infringement machine, which was built by the inducement. Now, I think that the respondents have quite clearly said that they don't think any injunctive relief is available going forward, but we're entitled under Section 502 of the Copyright Act to effective relief, not merely injunctive relief that says, go and sin no more, but relief that undoes the consequences of this inducement, of this massive effort to build a gigantic engine of infringement. And that is why they're just wrong about that. And you certainly can't affirm the Ninth Circuit and allow us to go forward with anything like that theory, because the Ninth Circuit said the only thing we can sue for is a situation in which we can show that we had knowledge of specific acts of infringement at a time when we could stop those specific acts of infringement. So there's just no way to affirm and let that go forward. Now, why is inducement not enough? It's not enough because, as Justice Scalia suggested, these companies already operate in the shadows. And a ruling here, which would be, I submit, a significant cutback of the Sony rule, that inducement is the only available ground of liability, would just leave them to paper over. You know, we do have some paper evidence here, paper trail here, but that just won't exist next time. And it's just not enough. And I submit that Sony was quite clear on this. Sony said that the staple article of commerce doctrine, not copyright law generally, and not secondary liability generally, but the staple article of commerce doctrine, the non-inducement part of the analysis, has got to strike an effective balance, a real balance that provides effective protection of copyright as well as protecting unrelated lines of commerce. Now, their rule is a rule of immunity. It's a free pass. It says all you've got to do is speculate about non-infringing use, and you can continue with infringement ad infinitum. Now, that's not a rule that protects innovation. That's a rule that destroys innovation. It certainly destroys the innovation of the creators that the copyright law is supposed to protect, and that's supposed to be the effective protection part of the balance that Sony said this law is supposed to strike. It also deters legitimate technological innovation, moving towards legitimate means of distributing this distributing in a digital format music and movies through the kinds of companies that filed amicus briefs here and are trying to do this legitimately. They are inevitably and invariably undercut by the kinds of businesses that respondents and the others run. So it deters innovation. It doesn't move it forward. And beyond that, Justice Kennedy, as you suggested, it isn't just that they get to use the value of our copyrighted materials as the seed capital. That's the whole business. That is the whole business, and that's the reality here, and that's the problem. They can talk about the hundreds of thousands or maybe even millions of uses, but the reality is that there are 2.6 billion downloads unlawfully every month. So what they're talking about as lawful is a tiny, teeny little fraction of what's really going on here. And the problem with the rule, which they say is a clear rule, but it obviously isn't in Sony, because Sony said strike a balance. And the problem with that rule Your Honor, is that it gives them a perpetual license to keep going forward with billions and billions of unlawful downloads a month. They never have to do anything to try to bring their conduct into conformity with law. They're not in the position of that inventor that you identify, Justice Scalia, who has to sort of think through, what am I doing? They're just in a position where they have every economic incentive in the world to maximize the number of infringing uses because they make more money when they do so. Now, and with respect to the reality of this situation, let me just say it. I must beg to differ, Justice Breyer, with the suggestion that this industry is thriving. What the facts are is that we have lost, the recording industry has lost 25% of its revenue since the onslaught of these services. And that's particularly critical because, remember, this is really, the recording business in particular, is really a venture capital business. Most of the records we put out don't make money. A few make a lot of money. Well, what do you think is getting traded on Grokster and Streamcast and the rest of them? It's the few that make all the money. So they're draining all of the money out of the system that we use to find new artists and foster development. Thank you.
The case is submitted. We'll hear our